This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News. Thank you to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This week, we will bring you news from the Spencer New Leader, and I will be reading from the Friday, June 5th, 2026 edition. I'm Walter Bird with Audio Journal. And we begin with the news from the Spencer New Leader, a publication of Stonebridge Press Newspapers, which is free by request to residents of East Brookfield, West Brookfield, North Brookfield, Brookfield, Leicester, and Spencer. Again, this is the Friday, June 5th, 2026 edition. And our first story, LHS bids farewell to class of 2026. Out of Leicester, Leicester High School held their graduation ceremony Thursday, May 28th, on the turf field at 7 p.m., the weather turned out to be perfect, and it was well attended. School Committee, Board of Selectmen, State Rep. Donnie Bertheum, and Senator Peter Durant were in attendance. LHS Class President Cassidy Poche welcomed the crowd while Natalia Callio recited the Pledge of Allegiance. Senior Nicole Toussaint sang the national anthem with flawless pitch and resonant tone. This started what would be an outstanding celebration of the culmination of K-12 education in Leicester. Reagan Perry delivered the Wolverine Spirit Address, saying, quote, "Many changes are bound to happen in our future, and the past 4 years as Wolverines have definitely prepared us for that. So let it be known that although many things may change with me, with you, one thing will always be true. We are Wolverines." End quote. The salutatory address was given by Natalia Callio. She quoted Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and spoke about life as a staircase. Quote, "It is not about having everything figured out. Rather, it is about accepting that you will never be completely certain of the outcome of your actions before you take them." End quote. The valedictory address was given by John Edward Gehigan. He spoke about his experience at LHS, referenced the movie Good Will Hunting, and the importance of always giving your best. Callahan concluded, "I hope that long after this speech is forgotten, you can still remember that people are too focused on their own lives to judge yours. So feel free to start, try, fail, and try again." End quote. Assistant Principal Jennifer Reynolds reminded students to be where your feet are. Seven principles to keep you present, grounded, and thriving. End quote. Based on author Scott M. O'Neill's book. She said, quote, "The next stage of your journey will certainly bring new challenges, so be present for the learning opportunities that will be afforded to you," end quote. Superintendent Brett Castigian concluded the speeches and thanked families, Leicester Public School staff, town officials, legislators, and most importantly, congratulating the class of 2026. His advice for students, quote, "As you go on to college, the military, the workforce, to meet all the incredible opportunities and challenges that await, don't ever lose that sense of humor and that carefree attitude that you have right now," end quote. In total, Leicester High School graduated 119 students on what will go down as a memorable graduation for the Leicester School community. Jason Blue brings us this next story in this week's Spencer New Leader. North Brookfield remembers longtime fire chief James Black. Blue writes, "The North Brookfield Fire Department and the community at large are mourning the loss of a legendary figure in the department's history, retired Fire Chief James Black. Black passed away May 7th at the age of 87, leaving behind a storied legacy in North Brookfield after spending 5 decades with the local fire department and serving a variety of roles. He started his tenure in 1960 with the Civil Defense Unit and served 50 years, rising through the ranks to captain in 1974, assistant chief in 1981, and finally fire chief in 1984, eventually retiring in 2010. Black was honored by the Board of Selectmen on May 19th with a moment of silence and a reading of a special tribute by the newest board member, Peter Orsi, himself a retired firefighter and the town's current EMS director. Said Orsi, quote, "Throughout his long and distinctive career, Chief Black earned the respect of his fellow firefighters and our community, which he faithfully served. For decades, Jim worked tirelessly to keep the residents of North Brookfield safe. Under his leadership, the fire department experienced significant growth and advancement throughout the 80s and 90s, helping to strengthen emergency services for generations to come," end quote. Orsi noted, "Black's career is a rare one of longevity and dedication, not just to the field of firefighting and public safety, but to a single town and department. Or she said, quote, 50 years is unheard of in the fire service. I don't think people realize that's 50 years of training, 50 years of meetings, 50 years of brush fires, 50 years of terrible car accidents and structure fires. What he had seen in a lifetime over a 50-year career helping the residents of this town, that's unheard of. And a lot of people had a lot of respect for him, end quote. The North Brookfield Fire Department posted a tribute honoring Black on social media, recognizing him as a committed and dedicated leader during his time with the department. Next up, Knox Trail Middle School Band secures fourth consecutive gold medal at Great East Music Festival. Out of Spencer, the Knox Trail Middle School Concert Band, under the direction of Mrs. Christina Noble, achieved an historic milestone this week by winning the prestigious gold medal at the Great East Music Festival for the fourth consecutive year. The ensemble competed against top-tier middle school music programs from across the region. Evaluated by a panel of expert adjudicators, the band received the festival's highest honor for its exceptional tone, technical precision, and expressive performance. Superintendent of Schools Paul Harvey said, quote, "This fourth consecutive gold medal is a testament to our students' incredible work ethic and passion for music. Achieving this level of excellence year after year requires immense dedication from the students, immense support from our families, and a commitment to the arts from everyone in our school district," end quote. The Great East Music Festival provides school ensembles with the opportunity to perform before acclaimed music educators and receive constructive evaluations to foster musical growth. Knox Trail Middle School's consistent top place cements its reputation as a premier institution for foundational music education. Leicester Special Olympics School Day Games return to LMS. In Leicester on Friday, May 22nd, Leicester Special Olympics School Day Games hosted its annual games event at the Leicester Middle School track and field. Athletes joined from surrounding school districts including Leicester, Macaulay Nazareth, Old Sturbridge Academy, and Assabet Valley Collaborative. The event kicked off with opening ceremonies featuring the Assabet Valley Marine Corps JROTC Color Guard leading the athletes around the track, along with Special Olympics torchbearer Stephen Geringi. Opening remarks were led by Committee Vice President and Treasurer Lenora Rust, and the athlete, coach, and volunteer oaths followed. From there, each team of athletes rotated through several stations featuring different skills, including running, throwing, relay races, jumping, soccer, and an obstacle course. Olympic Town continues to be an athlete favorite destination, offering arts and crafts, face painting, and temporary tattoos. All stations included alternative activities to ensure athletes of all abilities could compete and join in the fun. Once competition ended, the athletes refueled their bodies with the help of the JROTC, which passed out lunches. Closing ceremonies followed, with each athlete being announced and rewarded with their own Special Olympics gold medal in front of the cheering crowd of peers, volunteers, and community members. These Special Olympics games represent the very best of our community and what it has to offer. Our nonprofit organization works year-round to coordinate resources and raise funds to provide this special day for athletes of all abilities. With the support of Leicester School Administration, our games event helps our athletes build self-confidence, independence, and forge strong social connections. This day would not be possible without the incredible support of our community and friends. We want to thank our volunteers for the day, including high school students, school staff members, committee members, as well as many community members. Thanks to the local school districts and their support staff who joined us for the day with their athletes. We also want to thank local business sponsors for their generous support in helping make our annual games a reality. Athlete uniforms were sponsored by Electrical Wholesalers, Inc., New England. Gold-level sponsors this year included Cornerstone Bank and Everlift Industrial Truck. Silver-level sponsors are Country Bank, Jaguars, Lester Spencer Eagles, and Spillane Auto. Thanks to our bronze-level sponsors, Dean's Warehouse Services, Paradise Pizza, Hillcrest Country Club, Jess West Music, SNR Properties, and Spencer Agriculture Association. Additional thanks to Leicester Athletics Booster Club for donating water and fruit that fueled our athletes throughout the day. In-kind sponsors included St. Joseph St. Pius X, Big Y Supermarket, and Price Chopper. Well, next up, Marilyn Borst named Artist of the Month by Friends of the North Brookfield Townhouse. A former teacher with a master's degree in education and a lifelong volunteer, Marilyn Borst never thought of herself as an artist. She calls herself a creator who uses words to express her feelings, thoughts, knowledge, and experiences. She began writing in earnest while raising her four children, creating newsletters for several organizations, and researching and writing guidebooks for Preservation Worcester house tours. She tried writing radio dramas, parables, and love stories while taking part in WISE classes at Assumption. The lack of personal get-togethers and public meetings during COVID left Boris more time for reflection and poetry seemed to come naturally to her. She describes returning from a morning walk and sitting on the dock overlooking Brooks Pond, thinking about the beauty of individual snowflakes, the strange sounds coming from the expanding and contracting pond ice, or the calls of owls and hawks in the distance. She started carrying a notebook and pencil so she could write down thoughts that came into her mind. As a supplement to the required curriculum and to call attention to the townhouse as the place where residents gathered to discuss and come to agreement on town matters, Borst created a PowerPoint history program to be used in third grade classrooms in North Brookfield. The program employed a timeline and taught North Brookfield history by simulating a walk down Main Street describing three of the town's most important buildings. The two session classes ended with the students organizing their own town meeting. Borst's two books are devoted to history. She enjoys using the past and present to tell a story, but her work is not just a retelling of events. She begins each book with a theme. For George M. Cohen Was Here, it was North Brookfield residents' memories of time spent in the townhouse from its opening in 1864 until its closing in 2024, and their hopes for its restoration. And for the True Housewives of Holden, it was the reaction of women from 1915 to 2015 to town, state, and world events and the work they accomplished during those years. Borst's writing has given her the opportunity to meet and learn from people she grew to greatly admire. She credits their direction, suggestions, and support for her success and doubts that AI can ever replace this personal relationship. This Artist of the Month describes herself as having been writing all her life, quote, "First as a child, silly little poems about the seasons, then the diary entries and the newsy holiday letter that somehow turns into a newsletter, and finally a family history just waiting to be organized and completed," end quote. And that is the next chapter of her life. The correspondent Jason Blue brings us this next story, Brookfield's Finalizing Town Volunteer Policy. Blue writes, "The town of Brookfield is implementing a new policy that will provide a process for confirming volunteers and ensuring that waivers and other measures are handled by appropriate departments. The Brookfield Board of Selectmen approved a draft volunteer policy on May 27th, pending review by the town's legal counsel, which includes processes for waivers. Board member Beth Coughlin provided details about the policy, noting it will provide guidelines to solidify who the volunteers answer to and how any potential job risk or insurance issues are addressed prior to performing the work. Coughlin said, quote, "Fundamentally, it outlines that this is limited right now to a grounds maintenance program. There's potential in the future to expand it. We've historically done some building cleanup work with volunteers. It covers a scope of permitted activities," end quote. Occasionally, Brookfield's town departments may depend on volunteers for a variety of functions, most notably lawn care, seasonal cleanup, and beautification. Waivers provide an agreement of understanding between the volunteer and the town, covering risks of performing any of these jobs. The policy will better define who establishes these duties and manages the waivers. The document also clarifies that volunteers are used to supplement town employees, not replace paid labor. Said Coughlin, quote, "It makes it clear that the intent is not to replace paid town employees. It's just for times when we find ourselves in a bind. There's a lot of town, but not always a lot of employees," end quote. While the draft focused heavily on the highway department, who oversees the recreational fields, which are a common focus of volunteer work, it was discussed to add language such as, quote, "the appropriate overseeing board," end quote, to the policy permissions to broaden its scope. The board approved the document unanimously, sending it to their legal representatives for final review before its implementation. Next, local residents sworn in as correctional officers. This story is out of West Boylston. Worcester County Sheriff Lou Evangelitis recently administered the correctional officer oath to 14 graduates of the Worcester County Sheriff's Office 65th Basic Recruit Training Academy, or BRTA, during a ceremony at the department's Training and Command Center in West Boylston. Among the graduates were officers Sean Galarno of Warren and Xander Hooper of Spencer, who completed the Sheriff's Office 13-week correctional office training program. The academy prepares recruits for careers at the Worcester County Jail and House of Correction through classroom instruction and hands-on training in areas including de-escalation techniques, defensive tactics, first responder protocols, mental health awareness, suicide prevention, and physical fitness. This graduating class includes recruits from 7 Massachusetts communities, including 3 active duty service members or veterans of the United States Army. Said Evangelitis, quote, "After 13 rigorous weeks of training, I am proud to present some of the best and brightest future leaders in corrections. I am confident these graduates are prepared to join our ranks and help advance our mission of public safety," end quote. Before entering the academy, applicants must complete a written examination, physical fitness assessment, comprehensive background investigation, and a psychological screening. To promote fairness and integrity in the hiring process, Sheriff Evangelitis maintains a policy prohibiting letters of recommendations from elected officials and provides hiring preference to individuals who have honorably served in the United States Armed Forces. The Worcester County Sheriff's Office is currently accepting applications for its 66th Basic Recruit Training Academy, which begins in September of this year. For more information, visit www.worcestercountysheriff.com. LHS Culinary hosts breakfast for veterans. This is what's next out of the Spencer New Leader this week, and this is from Leicester. The Leicester High School Culinary Program hosted a free breakfast for local veterans May 19th. Superintendent Brett Castigian thanked LHS students, staff, and Project New Hope President Bill Moore for organizing a successful event. He said, quote, "This is just the start, and there is much more to come," end quote. Now, Bill Moore, an Air Force veteran, credited generous support from the following sponsors: Lilac Hedge Farm, Ella's Restaurant, Rascals, A1 Realty of Massachusetts, and Champagne Auto. And Moore said, quote, "Having the support of the entire community allows us to do special events for our veterans because they deserve it," end quote. Project New Hope's mission is to foster healing, resilience, and purpose beyond military service, honoring their service while strengthening individuals, families, and communities. School committee members and veterans Jim Ranke, the Coast Guard, and Paul Messier, Army, were on hand to support the event. Messier said, quote, "By partnering with Project New Hope, we are creating meaningful opportunities for students to engage directly with the community, reinforcing the importance of civic responsibility, gratitude, and service," end quote. Jim Ranke, who helped with the construction management of the restaurant, concurred, saying, quote, "Leicester High School is building community and highlighting American pride," end quote. Chef Andy O'Corrin, assisted by Stephen Dahlgren, helped students prepare the meals consisting of generous portions of home fries, bacon, scrambled eggs, toast, pancakes, coffee, and orange juice. Vietnam veteran Harry Castigian of the Marines remarked, quote, "The students are doing a great job, and it is nice to see community support for those who served," end quote. Besides hosting special events, the Wolverine Grill is open to the public on Thursdays from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., There is always a discount of 15% for all veterans active and retired. Veterans are encouraged to let their servers know to receive the discount. Printed receipts from the grill say thank you for your service. 10 financial steps to take before and after your wedding day. This is Trevor Nielsen's column, Financial Focus. Nielsen writes, "Getting married is a major decision that comes with a financial to-do list that's arguably more important than choosing a venue or cake. Talking openly about money can help set you and your partner up for a stronger future. What financial conversations should I have with my fiancé? Head into your marriage with honest conversations about money, including these four topics. Discuss how your families handled finances when you were younger, whether you're a spender or saver, and what debt you're willing to take on. Share how much you each earn, spend, and save. Discuss assets and debts, including mortgages, student or auto loans, and credit card balances. Your partner's debt can become joint debt after marriage. Align on a budget as a couple that reflects the life you want to build, where you'll live, what you'll spend on housing, travel, and hobbies, and how often you'll review your finances together. Talk through your goals. Make separate lists of short, medium, and long-term financial dreams and compare them. You'll likely find some common ground, and where you don't, look for ways to compromise. A financial advisor can help. Should I ask for a prenup? Couples with significantly different assets or debts, those expecting large inheritances, or those blending families are more likely to want to consider a prenuptial agreement. A prenup outlines how assets, debts, future income, inheritance, and even spousal support will be handled during the marriage and if it ends, but it cannot address child custody. Should my new spouse and I blend our finances? Regarding couples blending finances, there's no one right answer. Some couples combine everything, others keep accounts separate, and many land somewhere in between. Agree on who pays which bills, how many major decisions get made, and what spending threshold triggers a check-in. What financial tasks should we complete after getting married? Once you're married, these 6 tasks deserve attention. Take advantage of the special enrollment period, which typically lasts 30 days after getting married, to update employer benefits such as a health insurance. Revisit retirement plan contributions if your combined income has grown. Review insurance coverage. Combining homeowners or renters, auto and umbrella policies can often reduce costs. Make sure you have enough life insurance. Update beneficiaries on insurance policies, retirement plans, investment accounts, bank accounts, and real estate. If you change your name, order multiple copies of your marriage certificate. You'll need them to update your Social Security card, financial accounts, and employer and medical records. Update your W-4 withholding to reflect your new marital status and ask a tax professional whether filing jointly or separately makes more sense. Work with an attorney to create or update your will, medical directive, and financial and health care powers of attorney. Your estate plan should reflect your new life together. Marriage is a fresh start. With honest conversations, careful planning, and the right professional support, you can build a financial foundation as strong as your relationship. Well, we have another column by Charles, Lanterns Along Main Street. This week's column is titled The Empty Spaces Between Us. Charles writes, "The other day I arrived early, not accidentally, on purpose. I had an appointment across town, and years of experience have taught me that traffic, road construction, misplaced keys, and life's general unpredictability can make even a short trip an adventure. So I left with plenty of time to spare. Naturally, I arrived about 20 minutes early. What struck me wasn't the wait, it was what happened next. Nothing. I sat in my car. No radio, no phone, no errand to squeeze in before the appointment, no email to check, no task to accomplish. For 20 whole minutes, absolutely nothing happened, and it felt strangely unusual. There was a time when waiting was simply part of life. You waited at the doctor's office. You waited for the barber. You waited for a friend to arrive. You waited for a store clerk to finish helping another customer. Nobody liked waiting, but nobody expected otherwise. Today, we've become remarkably efficient at eliminating empty moments. Standing in line? Check your phone. Waiting for an appointment? Scroll through headlines. 5 spare minutes? Answer messages. 10 spare minutes? Watch a video. We're rarely alone with our thoughts anymore. Now, I'm not criticizing technology. I enjoy many of the same conveniences everyone else does. Being able to find information instantly still feels a little miraculous to someone who remembers searching through encyclopedia volumes. But I've begun to wonder whether we've accidentally crowded something out along the way. The quiet spaces, the unused minutes, the little gaps in the day where our minds once wandered. Some of my best ideas have arrived when I wasn't actively looking for them. Not while working, not while concentrating, not while trying to be productive. They showed up while sitting on a park bench waiting for an oil change, staring out a window or taking a slow walk with no destination in particular. For reasons I don't fully understand, the mind seems to do important work during those moments. It sorts things out. It makes connections. It notices details. It remembers things that matter. I suspect that's one reason older generations often appeared comfortable sitting quietly on a porch for an hour. As a young man, I never understood it. How could someone sit there doing nothing? Now I realize they probably weren't doing nothing at all. They were thinking, observing, reflecting, watching the world go by. Those activities may not produce anything measurable, but they are hardly a waste of time. In fact, they may be among the most valuable uses of time we have. The older I get, the more I appreciate the difference between being busy and being occupied. Busy is rushing from one thing to another. Occupied can mean simply being present where you are. One creates motion, the other creates perspective. That afternoon, sitting in my car with 20 unexpected minutes to spare, I watched people come and go. A man walked across the parking lot carrying a box that looked heavier than he expected. A woman stopped to help an older gentleman reach something that had fallen. Two strangers held the door for one another and exchanged a smile. Nothing remarkable, nothing that would ever make a headline. Yet those ordinary moments felt surprisingly interesting once I slowed down enough to notice them. Maybe that's what those empty spaces in our day are really for. They give us a chance to pay attention. Not to a screen, not to a schedule, not to the next thing demanding our attention. To the world directly in front of us. When my appointment time finally arrived, I went inside and got on with the day. But I've thought about those 20 quiet minutes ever since. Most of us spend a lot of effort trying to fill every empty space. Perhaps now and then it's worth leaving one empty. You never know what might find room to enter. Next up, Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club taking part in ARRL Field Day out of West Brookfield, the Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club, or QVARC, will participate in the 2026 ARRL Field Day, Saturday, June 27th and Sunday, June 28th, operating from 2 p.m. Saturday through 2 p.m. Sunday on the West Brookfield Town Common. The public is warmly invited to visit between 2 to 6 p.m. on Saturday and between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. Sunday to explore the world of amateur radio firsthand. Field Day is the largest on-air amateur radio exercise in the United States, bringing together tens of thousands of licensed operators to demonstrate the reliability, resilience, and public service value of amateur radio. For QVARC, it's also a chance to welcome neighbors, families, students, and anyone curious about radio, electronics, or STEM activities. Visitors will be able to watch live radio contacts being made across the country and around the world, explore the equipment and antennas used for emergencies and off-grid communication, and even sit behind a radio to make a contact themselves. Club members will be on hand to explain how amateur radio supports communities during storms, power outages, and public service events, and why these skills remain relevant in today's interconnected world. ARRL President Rick Roderick, K5UR, recently reflected on the long tradition behind Field Day, noting, quote, amateur radio has been part of the American story since the earliest days of wireless communication. For more than a century, the amateur radio service has advanced the nation's communications capabilities by fostering technical innovation, developing a pool of trained and skilled operators, strengthening emergency and public service communications, and promoting international goodwill. He emphasized these contributions show why amateur radio remains, quote, a uniquely resilient and volunteer-driven national resource, end quote. QVARC is proud to carry that tradition forward here in the Quabog Valley. Our members include hobbyists, engineers, emergency volunteers, and newcomers simply enjoying learning something hands-on and practical. The club meets the last Tuesday of each month, except for July and August, and welcomes anyone interested in getting involved or learning more about the hobby. Whether you're interested in emergency preparedness, electronics, shortwave communication, or just want to see what amateur radio is all about, Field Day is the perfect time to stop by. Everyone is welcome, and no experience is required. For more information about the Quabog Valley Amateur Radio Club, visit www.qvarc.com. Next, Brookfield Lions Club honors members for outstanding service and humanitarian contributions. The Brookfield Lions Club recognized 8 members for their dedication to community service and humanitarian efforts during the club's annual awards banquet held Thursday, May 21st at Hardwick Crossing Country Club in Gilbertville. Club President William Cass presented Melvin Jones Fellowship Awards to Lions Phil Bricault, Lion Jeffrey Hayes, Lion Gino Waugh, and Lion Stephen Ouellette in recognition of their exceptional service and commitment to Lionism. The Melvin Jones Fellowship, established in 1973 by Lions Clubs International, is considered one of the organization's highest honors. Named after Lions founder Melvin Jones, the award recognizes outstanding humanitarian service and support of the Lions Clubs International Foundation, or LCIF. Quote, within Lionism, the Melvin Jones Fellowship symbolizes a person who truly embodies the Lions motto, we serve. These recipients have consistently gone above and beyond through leadership, community involvement, and dedication to helping others, end quote. In addition to a personalized plaque and lapel pin, recipients of the fellowship also received congratulatory letters from Fabricio Oliveira, LCIF chairperson, recognizing their role in supporting humanitarian causes throughout the world. The letter noted that LCIF-funded programs support efforts to fight diabetes, preventable blindness, and childhood cancer, while also responding to natural disasters, feeding the hungry, empowering young people, and protecting the environment. Membership Chair Lion Andy Caron also presented the Lions District 33A Joseph J. Camarda Fellowship Award to Lion William Fulham, Lion Mark Kukansky, Lion Douglas Morrison, and Lion Paul Thompson. The Joseph J. Camarda Fellowship, established in 1986 by the District 33A Sight and Hearing Conservation and Treatment Fund, honors those who have made significant contributions to sight and hearing initiatives throughout Massachusetts. Named in memory of past International Director Joseph J. Camarda, the fellowship recognizes exceptional humanitarian service and dedication to improving vision and hearing health in local communities. Recipients receive a personalized plaque and lapel pin, while fellowship contributions support programs that provide assistance for individuals facing vision and hearing challenges throughout District 33A communities. Karen said, quote, the Lions Club has a long tradition of recognizing members who quietly make a difference year after year. These awards reflect a spirit of service and compassion that continues to define Lionism in our local communities, end quote. And there are a couple of photos accompanying this story. One is a photo with this caption, Melvin Jones Fellowship Award winners Gino Waugh, Philip Ricault, Stephen Ouellette, and Jeffrey Hayes, with Brookfield Lions Club Membership Chair Andy Caron and President Bill Cass. And they're all pictured, and the four award recipients are holding up their plaques. And there's another photo. Joseph J. Camardo Fellowship Award winners Mark Kokanski, William Fulham, Douglas Morrison, and Paul Thompson, with Brookfield Lions Club Membership Chair Andy Caron and President Bill Cass. Again, the four award recipients are holding their plaques. This week I am bringing you news from the Athol News. I'll be reading from the June 7th, 2026 edition. I'm Walter Bird with Audio Journal, and we start with, of course, the Athol Daily News. Our first story by Dominic Poli. Firm to determine potential uses of former cereal factory site in Orange. The civil and environmental engineering firm that removed debris from the site of a former cereal factory that burned down in 2022 has been tasked with determining potential future uses for the land. Fuss and O'Neill will conduct further environmental investigation to determine what is feasible for the empty lot at 1636 West River Street. Five buildings, including the vacant cereal factory, were destroyed as a result of an apparent arson by three juveniles on June 4, 2022. Tim Clinton, a senior project manager with Fuss & O'Neill, said this second phase of work will consist of concept and reuse planning. The firm got the Orange Select Board's blessing on May 20th when Clinton provided an update on the site. He said, quote, we've been helping the town for about 2 years now, and just to summarize the services we provided, it's really to design, help bid out, and oversee the removal of the brick pile. And that material was transported to a waste management facility in upstate New York, which is licensed to accept asbestos debris. We don't have any landfills like that in Massachusetts, end quote. Clinton said 7,675 tons of asbestos-containing brick, debris, and soil were removed from November 2024 to January 2025. Misting and coverings were used for dust control. Clinton said completion reports were submitted to the State Department of Environmental Protection in March of 2025. According to Clinton, the site was restored and backfill was imported and placed behind a foundation wall. At least 20 fire departments responded to the massive blaze in 2022, which sent embers into the air, with some landing on the vacant former blacksmith shop near 24 East River Street and causing such damage that it had to be demolished. There were also a small brush fire behind the fire station at 18 Water Street and a few others throughout town. The names of the three juvenile suspects, with ages ranging from 12 and 14 at the time, have not been released by authorities due to their age. The three faced criminal charges in connection with the crime. A Massachusetts land court decision transferred the 1.06-acre lot's ownership from Carmichael LLC to Orange last year. Police Chief James Sullivan previously said the former cereal factory was built in 1890 and spanned 59,394 square feet. 19,798 square feet on each of its three floors. The town receives $3.4 million from the state for cleanup costs. At the May 20th Select Board meeting, Clinton said he believes the site is a strong candidate for a deed restriction, which is applied to a property when residual environmental contamination remains after a cleanup. It was mentioned that the site could be a parking lot accommodating 50 to 70 vehicles. Town Administrator Matthew Fortier said at the meeting, quote, it's a town of Orange's parcel to keep, develop, sell, any and all of the above. It's really up to the town. But right now, we have a little over $300,000 left over from the state earmark. The earmark expires at the end of the calendar year, end quote. He said he is an advocate for monetizing the land's potential. And next up in the Athol Daily News, Amherst Mass Development launch Hampshire campus planning effort. This story is by Scott Merzbach. Out of Amherst, as Hampshire College prepares to sell its roughly 800-acre campus, town officials are partnering with Mass Development to help shape future development and ensure any redevelopment aligns with community priorities. Before entering into executive session last Monday to strategize over the possible purchase of Hampshire College property, the town council issued a statement sponsored by four councilors in support of having revenue-generating ideas for the campus. Hampshire College officials announced in mid-April plans to shut down at the end of the calendar year, though financial complications may force the college to shutter earlier than that. At-large Councillor Andy Churchill said the statement signals the town's key priorities to public bidders. These priorities include buildable land for housing, small business development, habitat protection, and the preservation of farming. Some of the property could also be considered for town needs. Churchill said, quote, it seems appropriate to have this deliberate process, and during our discussion, these priorities have emerged fairly generally across the council, end quote. Town Council also authorized Town Manager Paul Balkleman to work with Mass Development, the state's development finance agency, and Land Bank on a professional analysis. In a statement, Balkleman said, quote, the work with the town staff will lead to a full community discussion with the town's boards and elected leaders to plan and guide future development that will align with the town's overall goals. We especially appreciate the speed with which Mass Development has responded to our needs, end quote. Planning process will start this month, seeking to create a vision for the developable portions of the campus to bring in property taxes and a variety of housing. Mass Development will provide technical assistance and expertise on the environment, land use, and economic development, with services coming from the Horsley Witten Group, Dawson and Flinker, and U3 Advisors. Balkleman said the partnership with Mass Development means the town doesn't have to go through a procurement process for those services, which would likely cause delays. The value of the multiple engagement services is about $75,000, Balkleman said. Sandy Silk, Mass Development's Executive Vice President of Real Estate, said, quote, the loss of a major institution like Hampshire College creates challenges for the local economy as well as opportunities. Mass Development's real estate staff will enlist a team of consultants in a community-driven planning effort, equipping the town to engage prospective buyers and guide a future for the campus centered on economic growth and expanded housing options, end quote. Claire O'Neill, Mass Development's Senior Vice President for Real Estate Planning, told Council the agency values opportunities to collaborate and will work with the town step by step. The agency will also have various financing tools available. Amherst Director of Planning and Economic Development, Jeff Bagg, said the hope is to create a balance between habitat protection and development, with infrastructure like roads, water, and sewer already existing or that can be easily extended, allowing for creation of a zoning plan where implementation is done in phases. Bagg anticipates that a public meeting will take place in July during the first phase of this analysis, with the work extending from August to the end of the calendar year, when a zoning proposal would be brought forward. Balkleman said the town's voice, no matter what happens with any transactions the college might initiate, will mostly be through zoning. State Rep. Mindy Dome, Democrat of Amherst, and Senator Joe Comerford, Democrat Northampton, issued a joint statement in support of the work Mass Development will do. They said, quote, we know our constituents, advocates, and town officials have many ideas for the property, and we're confident such an assessment process, given the technical assistance from the state and the engagement of the community, will help explore proposals and produce recommendations that meet community needs and align with community values, end quote. A project website will be created in the coming weeks to provide updated information about the Hampshire College planning process, collect questions, comments, or ideas, and share updates from the town. Hampshire College announced about 2 weeks ago it had initiated the sale of its campus land and its assets, working with Region Commercial of West Springfield to manage the sale. In addition to roughly 800 acres, the campus includes 805,917 square feet inside 24 academic, residential, administrative, and recreational buildings. Three proposals have been made public by those making them, one from a group calling itself Hampshire Next, another from a Maryland-based philosopher, and the third for the open space coming from the trustees of Reservations and Kestrel Land Trust. Next up in the Athol News is a column, the My Turn column, titled Imagine There's No Country. And this is by Carl Meyer. Meyer writes, imagine if those we the people of 1776 had not believed in their own resolve and courage as a solution to a tyrant's abuse and greed. Imagine they'd not joined together and confronted the king, but instead shrunk before his spreading of fear and chaos, weak and divided like the mile-wide, inch-deep Platte River. Imagine that is the story they had to tell their grandchildren. Instead, they headed to the battlefield where the tyrant waged his war, pledging together their lives and sacred honor. They fought for free speech, a free press, religious freedom, the sacred right to vote and assemble. They passed on a democracy to all of us. On June 14th, just weeks before our nation's 250th birthday, Donald Trump will convene a cage fight on the White House lawn within view of the Lincoln Memorial. His birthday is June 14th, Flag Day, and he's been waving his own personalized Trump flags, advertising his view of a divided nation since well before he took office. The vision Donald Trump is fashioning for us and the world is revealed in the blood sport circus he's convening. Days from now, at the behest of the U.S. president, two humans, artificially divided, will punch and tear at each other like animals. It's a spectacle harkening back to the depraved appetites of brute Roman emperors. Trump will bathe in the pleasure he apparently derives watching from a sideline throne as brute pain is inflicted by men beating each other senseless, groveling for cash prizes on the nation's front line. That rot at the top legacy is what he's fashioning for us, a bedtime story about the end of democracy. That sadistic celebration will be seen as America's new calling card and flashed around the globe, convened by a rogue billionaire manufacturing war, chaos, election lies, and spewing dehumanizing rhetoric counter to our Declaration's aspirational self-evident truths that all men are created equal. That twisted vision, wholly uncoupled from human dignity and our civil rights, will be a stain on us all. I recently questioned Congressman Jim McGovern about the American people marching in Washington by September to ensure and protect the integrity of our upcoming election. I cited the president's continued roughshod run over the Constitution's 1st, 4th, and 14th Amendments, noting his openly scheming to subvert and game election results will not end before that one-day November contest convened in fall's darkening days. McGovern noted in remarks at Greenfield High School that night that he's buoyed by No King's Days and rallies countering ICE activities. He cited new voter registration as one possible solution to Trump's power grabs, but McGovern also shared personal fears that Trump will sabotage the fall elections, perhaps sending ICE or disrupting agents to polling sites. He's also afraid Trump might not leave office when his term ends. What McGovern didn't do was follow up those concerns with a statement like, "So here's my plan," or, "And this is how we're going to stop him." At an event with few young people attending, it was obvious there was no plan in place to defend the nation's civil rights. What is clear is Trump will continue bullying the courts, glorifying violence, and rewarding January 6th thugs and felons, while manipulating voting rules and fashioning lightning-quick gerrymanders in hand-picked red voting districts. McGovern's audience that night loudly vented their distaste for a president continually punching down. But his attacks on minorities, women, voting rights, speech, the press, neighboring countries, the post office, on struggling immigrant laborers whose work underpins so many lives clearly have a psychological toll. Abetted by billionaire friends, family, and cabinet members in starting wars, overturning international partnerships, and flaunting the rules in co-equal branches of government, Trump is finding success in draining off the focus and will respond to endless attacks on democracy. On December 24, 1776, Thomas Paine's new pamphlet, The American Crisis, was shared with George Washington's ragged, struggling troops. Its text famously began with, "These are the times that try men's souls." But soon thereafter, Paine candidly noted frustration that precious time had been squandered, that 8 months of hesitation had been costly. Quote, "Whether the independence of the continent was declared too soon or delayed too long, I will not now enter into as an argument. My own simple solution is that had it been 8 months earlier, it would have been much better. We did not make a proper use of last winter, neither could we, while we were in a dependent state," end quote. But those troops crossed the Delaware that frigid night, finally notching a small but psychological victory in the Battle of Trenton. I think the 1776 Patriots would have immediately recognized the specter of tyranny in our midst today. As Minutemen, they'd be resolved in their will to defend the unalienable rights derived and fashioned of the people, by the people, for the people, that they fought for and won so long ago. In goodwill and courage, they'd likely by now have settled on a date and time to confront their tormentor to demand redress. They'd likely have understood, too, that the place to assemble, defending their constitution by right as a free people, is in the sacred public square of democracy, the hallowed ground before President Lincoln's memorial on the National Mall. This was a column by Carl Meyer, who lives in Greenfield. Hampshire College warns it lacks the funds to complete student teach-out. The story is by Scott Merzbeck, and he writes, "Hampshire College's ability to handle the required teach-out of students who remain on campus this summer and fall, ensuring they will complete their degrees, could be impacted by a lack of financial resources to do this work," President Jennifer Chrysler wrote in a letter to the campus Saturday. In the letter, Chrysler told students, faculty, and staff, "There are questions about whether the college will have the money to undertake another semester. That semester would mostly be for so-called Division III students who would be able to graduate by the end of 2026. Kressler wrote, quote, our financial modeling shows that presently the college does not have enough available funds to cover the expected expenses for the teach-out, end quote. But Kressler cautioned that while college leaders knew this would be difficult, there are obstacles that have been put in the way. She wrote that the first obstacle is the ongoing analysis and negotiation over the unencumbered assets that could generate proceeds to fund operations. Another is a requirement for upfront payment from several vendors whose services are necessary for maintaining college operations. The third obstacle is a mismatch between expected teach-out expenses and revenue modeling based on cash received from fundraising and student enrollment. College leadership, since the April 14th closing announcement, has prioritized supporting students as they conclude the academic year, identifying transfer opportunities and preparing for the teach-out. Quote, from the outset, the board and I understood that successfully implementing the teach-out would require careful financial planning, additional fundraising, and close collaboration with our financial partners to ensure we had the resources necessary to fulfill our commitments, end quote, Kressler wrote. The letter came out before Monday, a deadline for some students to consider transferring to another college or university, and as some faculty and staff are in the midst of deciding whether to remain at Hampshire until other opportunities arise. Kressler wrote, quote, I can assure you we are actively exploring options to secure the necessary financial resources in time for the teach-out, and we remain optimistic. At the same time, we believe it is important to share this information now so members of our community can make informed decisions about their future, end quote. Should the teach-out go as planned, there would be a 17-to-1 student-to-faculty ratio for Division III students, and the agreement calls for providing stipends for additional committee chairs and committee members to support all Division III students with two-person committees. Next up in this week's Athol News, an Amherst man's quest to become the world's biggest Ant-Man fan? This story is brought to us by Bob Flaherty, and he writes out of Northampton, quote, hi, my name is Aaron Damon Rush, and I'm attempting to set a Guinness World Record, end quote. Thus, a young Amherst man publicly states his case. Damon Rush, 26, aims to set a record for the most memorabilia related to Ant-Man and the Wasp. Okay, of all the costume-clad superheroes of Marvel Comics fam, the diminutive duo does not strike the same chord of recognition as, say, Spidey, Hulk, Wolverine, or the Mighty Thor. Yet Damon Rush has been collecting anything connected to the ever-shrinking pair since he was a little kid in Holyoke, starting with 1960s Marvel comic books, a towering pile of which was left to him by a family friend. Of all those issues of Daredevils and Fantastic Fours he devoured, the two that made the greatest impression on the youngster were Avengers number 59 and 60. In these issues, Dr. Henry Pym, the troubled genius behind all this, Ant-Man, Giant-Man, Goliath himself, becomes the confidently abrasive Yellowjacket. Says Damon Rush, quote, it was a murder mystery. He told the Wasp he killed Goliath, his former self. I saw that superheroes could have different identities and split personalities, end quote. And he added, quote, then there was an animated Avengers cartoon from the 1990s, but they couldn't get the rights to use Captain America, Iron Man, or Thor, so they made Ant-Man and the Wasp the central characters. All this was grafted onto me early, end quote. His first action figure? Yellowjacket, naturally. Quote, the first ones came out in 2003 to 2005, but they didn't release another one until 2015, end quote. Against all odds, he got one. There was a lot more to comics collecting, he found, than comic books. For those who need to get caught up, Ant-Man came into being in 1962 at the height of the Marvel Renaissance when Pym, a brilliant biophysicist, found a way to shrink himself down to the size of an ant, whereby he mounted a flying ant and cybernetically led his antly hordes into battle. Then his girlfriend, Janet Van Dyne, agreed to become the Wasp, wings, stings, and all. Even with all the shrinking, the duo could still pack a hell of a wallop, you know, like Mighty Mouse. They go on to marry, co-found the Avengers, become stars of their own comics, and spawn three movies. Wasp will also serve as leader of the Avengers, hailed by Captain America as the bravest member of the team. There's more to this, though. Pym's deteriorating mental state, the domestic violence, the divorce, his giving up the Ant-Man identity to others, and his momentary pivot to the dark side, where he created the nastiest of villains, the raging robot Ultron. Such is the frank allure of Marvel Comics. These people have issues. Quote, Ant-Man became my thing, end quote, said Damon Rush, who realized some 15 years later, I probably have the most Ant-Man stuff anywhere. Now, to prove that to Guinness, he thought that A2Z Science and Learning Toy Store, his childhood home away from home, would be the ideal place to make the attempt. The store's co-owner, Devin Boulay, said, quote, Aaron used to work at A2Z, and he does Dungeons & Dragons with the kids here, his dungeon dwellers. This is our first time hosting a world record, end quote. Her daughter, Ella, couldn't take her eyes off the squadron of plastic ants on the display table. The collection, which features a mountain of comic books and a battalion of action figures, commands significant space in the store's rear gallery. Aaron's partner, Dre Bourgeois, who'll serve as a videographer for the official account, but who shockingly does not read comic books, said, quote, "Our bedroom looks very bare right now without it. I don't care for superheroes in general. I'm sorry," end quote. Stifling a collective gasp from the invited guests, he continued, quote, "But every Christmas I buy Aaron an Ant-Man bundle," end quote. The couple, who graduated from Hampshire College, grieve over its closing, said Damon Rush. Quote, "I was running D&D games at the time and wanted to break down that whole thing, not coding games, but breaking down what makes a game social phenomenon. Outside of Finland, where am I going to get that? Hampshire got me that," end quote. His day job is alumni coordinator at North Star in Sunderland, which he says, quote, "takes a Hampshire College approach with middle and high school kids and gives them hope," end quote. He is the son of former New Century Theater stalwarts Kate Damon and Sam Rush, who always supported him in his Ant-Man quest. He laughs, saying, quote, "before online shopping, I'd drag my mom from store to store," end quote. Quote, "I have a little invested in this," end quote, smiles his mom, who even brought two small figurines to add to the count. When the collection is all laid out like this, one has to wonder what it all cost. Quote, "Ant-Man stuff is on the cheaper end. I never paid more than a couple hundred dollars for a plastic figurine," end quote, he said. His prized possession, the 64-year-old Tales to Astonish comic number 49, Giant Man's debut, was bought for $50. On May 17, 6:30 p.m., Kristen Reeder and Phoebe Zacks, co-owners of Comics and More in East Hampton, arrive, carrying on a pre-count banter with Damon Rush that only a real comic book hound could follow. In fact, the effervescent Reeder believes the only authentic way to experience superheroes is through the inked pages of comic books. Quote, "the way you fill space, two-dimensional space, you can't get this in the movies," end quote. Reeder, along with Celine Mix of Greenfield, will serve as official witnesses, both furnished with handheld tally counters that will click off each item presented. As dragons, bears, giraffes, gorillas, and unicorns, the store's regular denizens, look on from their high shelves, the crowd leans in. Dre Bourgeois hits record on his phone and the counting begins. First up are the comic books, framed and otherwise. Affixing a tiny numbered sticker to each item, Draymond Rush narrates, 1, 2, 3, end quote. He must reach 1,018, the estimated figure he gave the Guinness officials when he applied. Quote, 7, 8, I can see how this could get boring, end quote. Reader suggested overdubbing some superheroic music over the thing, but Damon Rush said, quote, "no, the rules don't allow any editing." 9, 10. 10, roared Reader, and the crowd came to life and cheered every milestone ending in zero. "Also, as the experts here, call me out if I try to sneak a non-Ant-Man thing into the count," said Aaron. 39, 40, 41. Quote, "while I was already skeptical, but keep going, my friend. You're doing great," end quote, said Reader. 48, 49, 50. 50, cried Reader. "Yes," came voices. 100, pandemonium. To save time, Damon Rush uses his comments sparingly. 138, 139. Ant-Man has to wear doll clothes because he's trapped in a house. 140, 150, 150. Janet Van Dyne comes back from the dead, adds Reader. Click. 243, first appearance, Hank Pym as Ultron. 244, 245. Damon Rush has now taken to singing the numbers, as he counts, in a gorgeous soprano. Quote, "this is the issue that made Ant-Man and Hank Pym my favorite characters. You can still see the jelly bean stains, typical of a 9-year-old. 261, 262, next binder. One of the cheering onlookers is Samantha Hines of Williamsburg, who'd go to comic conventions with Damon Rush when they were teenagers. Quote, "that's where he got some of these things. It's been so exciting to watch him amass this over the years, but I'm more of a DC person, actually," end quote. Wait, a DC person? Isn't that like wearing a Mets hat at Yankee Stadium? She laughs. Quote, "he got me to read a lot of things I probably wouldn't have, and vice versa," end quote. She collects, too, mostly Batman family merchandise. Her holy grail of comic dom, Batgirl 2000, the intro of Cassandra Cain. Batgirl 2000, comes Damon Rush's fist thrust from across the room. Detente. 700, yelps getting louder. 741, a costume Wasp has never worn. 742, 742, blurted Reader. I can't help it, I'm so excited. 780, 781. Then what's this, Wasp's rolling head? That's all that's left of her, said Damon Rush. Well, we do have two dogs, Bourgeois explained. 900! Yikes. 1,000! All hearts beat as one. Number 1,089 shows a model tableau of Ultron in a death rattle with limbs missing and a hole in his metallic gut. Does this signify the end of one of Marvel's greatest villains? Quote, he's not Animaltron. He always comes back, said Aaron. 1,090, then moving to a rack of garments. 1,097, Avengers number one Crocs. 1,098, Ant-Man socks. 1,100, 1,110, then finally, an Avengers mini stocking. 1,120, which is 102 more than the 1,018 I needed to set the world record, Aaron said. Samantha Hines was all ready to pop a cork and toast him with champagne. Let's hold that thought, Damon Rush said, as Reader and Mix signed documents. Quote, I'll submit this along with a full inventory. Then I wait 12 weeks for the verdict on whether or not I have the record, end quote. You have the record in my heart, cried Devin Boulay, speaking for the crowd. Said Dre Bourgeois, quote, one thing for sure, this was the most fun any of us ever had, counting, end quote. Next up, it's time for Sportsman's Corner, Bears in Our Backyard, and this is a call by Mike Roach. He writes, in previous columns, this space has made mention of black bears, which have become part of our local ecosystem. Black bears are big and impose themselves on rural, agricultural, and residential residents. Black bears have adapted to people and now spend more time in residential areas where they can easily find food like birdseed and trash. This causes a bear to lose its fear of people and see them as a source of easily obtainable food. This behavior will easily lead to the bear becoming a threat to human safety and possibly needing to be euthanized. All of us can do things to help keep bears wild by taking down bird feeders, protecting livestock with electric fencing, securing all other human-associated food sources, and never intentionally feeding wildlife. These steps are effective when many people participate, so encourage your friends and neighbors to also make changes that benefit bears and people. Recent conversations have made it clear that bears are everywhere, and in several sections of the North Quabbin, bear sightings are a daily occurrence. Ultimately, bird feeders can harm bears. Feeders draw bears and other wildlife into residential areas and near people. Bears that find bird feeders in backyards will start to look for other food sources, like backyard chickens, goats, and other small livestock. This causes bears to lose their fear of people through a process called habituation, which can lead to the bear being euthanized to ensure human health and safety. You should remove bird feeders at the first sign of bear activity and avoid leaving empty feeders out. Biologists have noted evidence that bird feeders may prevent bears from denning. Most black bears enter a den between November and March when natural food becomes scarce. However, a bear may forego denning if there's plentiful human-associated food available. This could create more human-wildlife conflict as bears would be looking for food year-round. A better way to attract local birds is to grow native plants, shrubs, and trees, and adding a water feature like a bird bath to attract songbirds. These alternative actions may increase the diversity of birds you see and will prevent the unnatural feeding of bears and other wildlife. Anyone with bees, chickens, goats, sheep, and other livestock needs to take all measures to protect them from bears. Bears, like all animals, look for the easiest source of food. Electric fencing is required as standard coops or pens will not keep a bear out. We all must secure garbage, compost, and other attractants by storing them in closed containers in a storage, outbuilding, or bear-resistant trash can caddy. Put garbage by the roadside the morning of the pickup, not overnight. You can use double bags or sprinkle garbage with ammonia to help reduce odors. Empty garbage cans still attract bears, so clean cans frequently and store cans inside. Do not put meat scraps, greasy, oily, or sweet materials in your compost pile. These kinds of food attract bears and other animals. Clean your barbecues and grills after each use. Do not leave food scraps, grease containers, or spilled grease in your yard. Protect your pets. A dog can trigger a bear to be aggressive, so keep dogs leashed whenever they're outside. If you come upon a bear while with your dog, keep your dog leashed, back away slowly, and leave the area. If you see a bear in your yard, discourage it with loud sounds. An air horn is good. Make as much noise as possible. If you encounter a bear while hiking or camping, talk in a calm voice and slowly back away. Do not approach bears or intrude between a female bear and her cubs. Do not run. If a bear is sighted in town, leave the animal alone. In most safe situations, if left alone, the bear will return to the forest on its own. If a bear is in a populated area, contact the Environmental Police Radio Room at 800-632-8075 or the nearest Mass Wildlife District office to report the sighting. we all need to discourage bears from being around dwellings. This community news is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Walter Bird. Thank you for listening.